Hello, I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winner Mitchell. Hey there, Winner.
Hi.
And the host of NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, and great leader of Maximum Fun, Jesse Thorne.
Hey, Guy, how's it going?
It's so lovely to have you here, Jesse. Thanks for joining us.
It's a delight to be here.
Unfortunately, we're missing Oliver and Margaret this week. I'm not exactly sure why. The presumption is that it is Mordecai cosplay involved.
No, Wobbler, this is a message to you. You take your teeth out on your own time. Not on the frickin' Pop Rocket time. This just is the first warning, second
we
warning.
We have Katy Perry to discuss. What does she think?
I need to know.
You know what I think we should do? I think she may be getting her teeth out right now. I think we get her on the phone.
Yes.
And just,
make this viral.
Just let it roll. Just all Colin has to do, roll tape.
A little extra.
All right. To help you get to know our panel, each week I'm asking them a revealing question about their own pop culture habits. We've actually started crowdsourcing this on the Maximum Fun Reddit, so here's the question from Redditor Icing Burns. Which TV theme song from your youth are you shocked you can still remember in its entirety? Winner Mitchell.
I'm going to say Punky Brewster. Please don't have me recite it because I'm currently stoned. But it came into my head the other day.
Winter takes her work here very seriously.
This just imbues it. I thought about it the other day because I was thinking about the time that Cherry was locked in the refrigerator because my refrigerator needed to be clean. So those are
so
post-Punky Brewster thoughts.
If I start you off, can you maybe keep it going?
Yes.
Maybe the world is blind. Do do do
do do do. Just a little unkind. Oh no.
Jesse.
Well, the one that's been the most present in my life lately is Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, yes.
Because it just recently popped up on Netflix, and my son, who's three, and I have been watching it because I have a giant,
giant
print of Pee-wee on the wall, and he always was like, "What is that picture of that weirdo?" Basically. Who is that strange man in our home? You know, and he loves it. He was just apparently we heard from his preschool teacher yesterday that he's been talking a lot about Pee-wee at school. So he's got a long life to look forward to that's probably will mirror mine, which is what? You alienate people until you hit social awareness at about 15 or 16, and then you become artsy.
Can we get a taste of the Pee-wee's plate?
Come on in and pull yourself up a chair. Let the sun begin. Come on, the fun begin.
Get to
come
my favorite part.
And let down your hair. I'm not going to do the whole. I'm not going to do the whole thing. That's enough of a grown man singing in a Cyndi Lauper voice.
I have strong savant abilities with 80s and 90s sitcoms. The one that is always most ridiculous in my head that I remember is the short-lived Growing Pains spinoff Just the Ten of Us, where Coach Lubbock goes off to Eureka, California, and raises his too large Catholic family. I'm now going to sing it in its entirety. Life is a race, and I know I can make it, because I'm learning the rules of the game. If I play it, take it by heart, play it minute by minute, I just might make the Hall of Fame. Oh, what can I say? I'm doing it the best I can. I won't do the rest of it.
I like that. One of my favorite things about that show, and I didn't see it in its original run, but I saw a lot of it. If you've seen the documentary Eureka Plays Itself.
No.
It's not a real documentary.
Oh, my God.
Just that they chose Eureka is amazing to me. Do you think that there was a conversation about whether to set it in Eureka or Wyreka? Which are both real places.
And very.
I'm pretty sure there are no Catholics in Eureka. Anytime something is said in Sacramento, it's like, you can do better than
this. I never knew that I'm from Northern California, so is Jesse. It's so shocking that it was set there. I didn't even realize it. I just knew that it felt like they lived in an abandoned lot, like a place where like Children of the Corn was filmed.
Sounds about right.
About right.
It could also have been Reading.
Hey, it gave valuable TV credits to most of the guys on Friends playing the boyfriends of the girls on the show. Thanks for that, Icing Burns. You made people listen to us sing. If you'd like to suggest a warm-up question, head over to the Maximum Fun Reddit page and chip in. Chime in? I don't know.
Coming up on this, either way.
Coming up on this week's show, Winter Mitchell will lead our discussion of the female cast Ghostbusters reboot, and Jesse reprises his signature segment, SZM. But first, let's find out which arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. And just about everybody this week is going to end up talking about the Super Bowl. So, for example, this week I have been all about Rob Gronkowski as a concept.
Wait a minute. What's the difference between concept and application here?
Because the thing is I don't care about Rob Gronkowski tight end. His ability is that he is good enough for us to pay attention to is all I worry about. That's all I need. Because, like, sports is so boring so much of the time. Like, these are people who are like, oh, I'm good at jumping or throwing, so I don't have to have a personality. And I like that this guy is, you know, Brian Bosworthing it a little bit while being good enough to actually play in the NFL. And he's just having such a good time, and it's lovely to watch, and it's exciting to watch. You know, the Yo Soy Fiesta of it all. It's really good. And part of me is a little bit self-aware about the fact that, like, okay, so we have these narratives that we're comfortable with from sports where, like, if you're talking about Jesus and how much you hate abortion, we'll get behind that and you get to talk. But if you're talking about, like, Chris Klewe talking about World of Warcraft and how much he loves gay marriage, suddenly he's out of a job and nobody wants to hear from him. And this is, like, right on the borderline because it is just sort of, like, bro-y frat dude stuff, but it is a little bit subversive and very fun. And not sort of like the responsible, this is my charity and this is how much I love my mom and all of that stuff. That said, him going on Kimmel and being like, yeah, I just want to throw some haymakers about the fight where, like, the thing of black dude gets thrown out of the game, white dude is just having a good time, you know. Black dude does a victory dance or wants to wear gold shoes. It's like, hold up, little buddy.
Who wore gold shoes?
Marshawn Lynch, I believe, wanted to.
Let's save this for hashtag #ThatSism because that's my signature segment,
yes.
And you're breaking out all of my topics here.
I'm sorry. Okay, then let's just go back to Rob Gronkowski. His shirtless Instagram presence.
okay, so now we're getting down to it, guys.
The fact that there is always a 5-foot-tall woman standing next to him at, like, exactly dick height.
Don't you think we need those kind of people in football? I miss having those kind of people.
One of the things that most impresses me about Rob Gronkowski is he is a human monster. I mean, he is. If it would, there are athletes, and then there are athletes. And I think that a tight end is the perfect example of someone that you can't believe is real. Because Rob Gronkowski has to be big enough to block on the line, but he has to be fast and athletic enough to head out into the field to catch a pass. And so what
and
you
also
end
tall
up with,
enough to be higher than the person trying to stop him from getting a pass.
Exactly. So he is terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, there was a segment on Conan where, you know, I mean, all football players are terrifying in their football outfits.
Right.
But in human clothes, they look insane. There was a segment on Conan where he and Marshawn Lynch played video games against each other. It was a very sweet, funny segment. But what I was struck by was, you know, sure, Marshawn Lynch looked like a professional athlete. But Rob Gronkowski looked like a professional wrestler. Like, he's monstrous.
And he's having fun. And that's what I want to see is people who are clearly loving the good time that they're getting to have. Tom Brady showing up in his little business suit as though, oh, I'm just the vice president of throwing the ball. I don't want to deal with that. All right, Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
Well, I'm all about the Super Bowl. I mean, I feel like no matter what, the lead up to it, the run up to the actual event is always just fraught. It doesn't matter if your teams are playing. It doesn't matter if you're actually there or not. But I don't get FOMO often because I've done everything, but I had serious FOMO this weekend.
Wait, what is FOMO?
Fear of missing out.
Okay.
There were so many amazing parties happening this weekend.
I honestly thought it was a heterosexual guy who dresses cute.
I wish. Where are those? Except for Jesse.
Thank you. I'm proud to be a FOMO.
No, there was a lot of great parties before the event. And then the actual, I went to my buddy Jonathan Sadowski's, watch Young and Hungry on ABC Family. I went to his house in Laurel Canyon, and we had the most amazing Super Bowl party that
Winter,
was just.
Winter, I'm going to have to ask you, in the future, if you're going to drop names, they can't be names from ABC Family. No
That's
offense to your friend Jonathan Sadowski. He sounds like a great guy.
He threw an amazing party, Sadowski. Okay. You did a great job.
Okay.
But the actual game itself was really entertaining. I don't care about either team. Can I tell you my most favorite part of the actual Super Bowl every time Seattle scored, they'd play grunge as an outro. So they played Black Hole Sun at one point. They played some Luscious Jackson at some point. And I was just like, I'm sure there was some Pearl Jam and Temple of the Dog at some point. But I just thought to myself, that's cool. Whoever that segment producer or whoever produced that part was just like, he was like, I'm definitely going to do it. Every time they score, we're just grunge. So that was actually my favorite part of the Super Bowl.
One of my favorite things about the Super Bowl, just as a TV watcher, is it's the best produced 3 hours of television
it
of
really
the year.
It really is.
It looks the best. Like, every...
Better than red carpet.
It's better than the Oscars.
I'm sorry, it's better than the Oscars. It's like basically 10 hours back to back of just straight up chock-full programming.
Something that I really like.
Everything.
As a person who likes sports, something that I really like about the Super Bowl is that because there are hundreds of millions of Americans who follow football, you get to have the level of grandeur of the Olympics without that
eight-week
insulting
time suck.
Without the 8 week time suck, but without that kind of insulting television presentation that presumes that you have to be tricked into watching the actual sport happening. And that for me as a sports fan, like, I actually like watching sports. I like watching many Olympic sports, but when I watch them, I'm like, why are we watching it in this crazy time compressed? Like, they cut some people out of it. They don't show parts of it. Most of it is just behind the scenes stories about surviving shark attacks.
Love a good cancer package.
So I like that the Super Bowl has all of the grandeur and ridiculousness and pageantry of the Olympics, but also presumes that you might actually enjoy the sports involved.
Yeah. And it was like that it was a game with adventure to it is so rare.
Yeah. There was some adventure to it. I mean, I'm going to let Jesse talk about the best part of the Super Bowl.
Thank you. I did not watch the Super Bowl because I am a San Francisco 49ers fan, so it was like trying to decide who to root for, the Emperor or Darth Vader.
Wait, you get to talk about the best part, and
I watched it post facto using internet.
Jesse, what are you all about this week?
Missy Misdemeanor Elliott, if you're wondering which Missy Elliott I'm referring to. So like a week ago, the producer of Bullseye, Julia, and I were driving to a lunch date, and she and I were talking about what's going on with Missy Elliott. Why haven't we seen her in so long? I have these sort of cockamamie made-up theories in my head, like maybe she's just super rich and chill. Maybe she's like a Queen Latifah-style lesbian and she just wants to not be bothered.
I think my presumption was private lesbian who understands you can't invite your wife on your daytime show and still expect to be in the closets.
Right. So I had all these theories about what's up. Maybe she had a falling out with Timbaland and she wasn't confident about producing her records herself or something. I don't know. Like, there was a million different theories I could come up with to explain where Missy was. And then there was Missy. I love Missy so much. She's still – this is something that I think maybe Oliver said on Facebook, which – is so impressive is the hits that she performed are now 10 and 15 years old.
Yeah.
And they still sound like the future.
They do.
That is something that I think is absolutely amazing.
Not many people can do that.
Yeah. Missy Elliott is as good as it gets.
1,000%
brilliant
sales.
Genius.
I would like to say my one Super Bowl prediction was Katie opens with Roar and ends on Firework, which is, I mean, that's, you know, if you were actually betting on that, there would have to be a significant spread because that's like...
No, but I think what people are forgetting is that Katy Perry is Katy freaking Perry. We know all of her songs. Katy Perry is on the road to legend. For her to take a step to the side, that's actually really super old school and really, it wasn't charitable. That was very, like, it takes a lot of dampening of your ego to say, I'm going to let her straight up just take over because she
It was a perfect choice. Like,
it was a perfect choice. Before, I could have done without Lenny Kravitz. He took up like a minute and a half.
Before going in, we were speculating at the party I was at, who is she going to have here? Because it can't be one of her contemporaries.
No.
I was worried that it was going to be some dad musician, which Lenny Kravitz a little bit is.
A little bit? Lenny Kravitz is the king of all dad musicians.
He's the dilf of all dad musicians.
He's the dilf. His willingness and capacity.
You can still get it. I just didn't need that 90 seconds. because I could have taken that back and given it to Mitzi.
He is 50 years old and cannot wear a shirt with the best of them. And
can you guys imagine what it's like to watch Lenny Kravitz as someone who doesn't want to sleep with him? Can you imagine what torture that is?
He's got 1.5 songs.
You guys, oh but can God. We talk about the fact that when
he has 1.5 songs that he borrowed from other people that went 30 years before him.
No, but Missy, just really quick, Missy Elliott was giving a performance that was almost like she's been waiting for the last 20 years in wait to sort of get to the point to do that. She gave that camera every single thing and left it on the floor.
I feel like every year at the Super Bowl in the halftime show, it's like, you know, they have like, oh, whoever, Madonna or
Bruno Mars last
year. Bruno Mars, whatever, right? And then they do it, and a lot of these people are talented, skilled performers. And then they have like Prince or something on, and then everyone is like really surprised when Prince is like way more exciting than The Who.
Yeah.
Like, no offense to The who are legendary musicians, but like, yeah, no shit. It's Prince.
Yeah.
Like,
there's only so many of those artists
what's
though,
this?
Left.
It's fun to watch people do actual dance music? What? Funky people are more fun to watch than rock and roll people that just stand there and play guitars? Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, I'm shocked to learn this. Watching Katy Perry sing wanly while things happen around her is not quite as good as watching Prince do the splits? Yes. And I have no beef with Katy Perry.
She wrote a gigantic lion.
She wrote a gigantic lion, Jesse. She put her life at risk.
In his own studio, there was the moment where Jesse Thorne looked and realized that both Winter Mitchell and I were here and he was speaking of Katy Perry. It was a beautiful thing.
It was the most beautiful thing ever. You caught my eye. And I was like, you know I'm a Katy fan.
The years, the dark, dark years of the dad bands playing, it's like chocolate-infused chocolate. Like, this is already 3 hours of, you know, people who need Cialis. Do we really need a Cialis commercial as the halftime show?
Well, here's what I'll say about Katy Perry. I want to talk about Katy Perry for a minute. So I am not a fan of the kind of music that Katy Perry makes.
Okay.
I know you are, Guy. I know that's like your top favorite kind of music, but like it's not music made for me.
Right.
Obviously, right? But like, and also, I wish Katy Perry was good at singing or dancing. Usually pop stars are good at one or the other.
Right.
However, those things having been said, Katy Perry is good looking.
Yes.
She's charming. She does a perfectly nice job. The kind of music she makes is not like it's dependent on her being good at singing. She's perfectly competent at singing, and it's fine. It's not a problem for her records.
Her music and her love for music reminds me of if Freddie Mercury were an American girl born in California, and if things had gone the right way. Well, I mean, like, she really is she's arena pop, and that's a very rare thing.
What you're saying is if AIDS medications had been better in the 90s, we would have
had... I did not just compare Katy Perry to
we would have had
Freddie
with Yo Gabba Gabba shark spot.
Nails her image, and she likes music. I'm going to defend her to the hilt.
Hey, I'm not attacking Katy Perry. In fact, my whole point here, what I'm building up to here, is that Katy Perry's performance was delightful. I mean, the thing that Katy Perry gets, I think, is that it's her job to be fun. Mm-hmm. Those dancing sharks, like, that's great. That's super fun. That was on the Super Bowl.
A lot of technique and coordination.
That lion she was riding, that was
great.
She rode
a lion.
I really enjoy that. I had never thought about this, but Katy Perry is working uphill anytime she's not able to shoot whipped cream out of her boobs. Like, having to perform live, she did amazing work. You guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk the Ghostbusters reboot after this.
Hi, I'm Brian Fernandez, a.k.a. Sonny D., producer of Jordan, Jesse, Go.
I'm Lindsay Padlas, producer of Wham Bam Pow.
We're the stars of Maximum Fun's first web video series, Brian and Lindsay Will Totally Eat That.
Someone throws us a snack, we eat it, and then we rate it on a scale from yummy to crummy.
We've recorded a pilot, and we're raising funding for the series on Kickstarter until February 20th.
And if we receive enough backers, we will receive a huge challenge grant from our friends at Hover.com.
Go to MaximumFun.org/totesy for more info or find us on Kickstarter.
Question for you.
Shoot it at me.
You gonna eat that?
Totally.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brand, and with me in the studio...
Winter Mitchell.
Jesse Thorne.
All right, Winter, talk to us about the Ghostbusters.
Well, last week, The Hollywood Reporter had breaking news.
Hold on! Dateline Hollywood!
A cast is in negotiations for the Ghostbusters reboot, you guys. We have Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, and SNL newcomers Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones with Paul Feig direct. Is I'm saying his
Feig,
name?
Feig.
Oh, sorry, Paul.
I happen to be friends with Paul Feig. Can you please?
Well, apologize to him on my behalf. So I, for one, am thrilled this long American crisis is over, and we have been anointed with four fabulous women to replace the original cast of Ghostbusters. I'm not sure about you, but this movie was specifically designed for my generation and still speaks to me. It made horror comedies more mainstream, and it was another example of the box office prowess of a unique concept matched with very talented improvisational actors. 1984 was the year many important films in my life, in my childhood, were released. Beverly Hills Cop, Police Academy, Splash, Revenge of the Nerds, Mickey and Maude.
Really?
Excuse you. Mickey and Maude is a cult favorite. I don't understand. Didn't understand it then. I completely understand it now. It is egregious. However, Dudley Moore was delightful. Rest in peace. They all hold a very special place in my heart. So,
I like that. I feel like Winter's entire like taxonomy of film is based on just like little signs from the video store. It's like, hold on, that is a cult favorite. I am sorry, but Ghostbusters happens to be a staff pick.
I'm trying to do my intro without sounding like I'm reading a report at school. Now we get to the part that's going to bother Jesse, or Jesse's going to approve of. Ghostbusters as a franchise is uneven. Many love the original and hate the sequel. Aykroyd, Murray, Ramis, and Hudson were already up in age by Ghostbusters 2, and the movie industry was entering this phase where box office and studios were very dependent on tentpole summer films. Then there was the inevitable commercialism. It was a cartoon, a terrible console game, a crappier cereal, but an overall pretty good high C flavor.
Can I ask this? Do we know what happened with Ghostbusters the cartoon versus the real Ghostbusters? Can you guys explain
didn't
that
have,
to
they
me?
They didn't have rights, I heard. I read.
Okay.
They didn't have rights to
certain
things.
I know this because I was obsessed with Ghostbusters even for – and it was a terrible show. I don't know why I liked
it. Wait, which one? Regular Ghostbusters or the real Ghostbusters?
Well,
because there were – for anyone who's too young to know this, there were two Ghostbusters cartoons,
yes.
One of which was based on the movie Ghostbusters,
yes.
And one of which was called Ghostbusters but didn't feature the characters from the
exactly.
movie Ghostbusters.
Right. Okay. So Ghostbusters, which was not about the movie, had been a very, very short-lived show in the 70s. And then Ghostbusters came out, and it was a huge hit. And the guy who had the IP for that Ghostbusters cartoon was like, cha-ching, and was immediately like, we can go back into production and just churn out as many terrible episodes of this as we can. And then they tried to come up with a cartoon version of the movie, and they had to call it The Real Ghostbusters and give Slimer a personality. And then I became...
Slimer also solved crime.
I really wanted the toys of the non-movie Ghostbusters from the JCPenney catalog. And there was like an entire year of me just staring lovingly at them and trying to explain to my mom that I wanted them.
Circling them with a red pen until the ink soaked through and softened it to the point where you could separate that part of the catalog out.
I cannot for the life of me understand why. I also really liked Howard the Duck.
I also liked Howard the Duck. I'm with you, Guy.
Felt like you guys tag-teamed all up in my essay. I'm wrapping up. The women cast for the anticipated remake are Masters of Improv and Attitude, which means this... Jesse keeps laughing at every...
It's because you just said they're Masters of Improv and Attitude.
They are Masters of Improv and Attitude.
It's just a great turn of phrase.
Sass. It's like a Lifetime show. Which means that the script will be a skeleton upon which they lay the muscle and dexterity of their Herald teachings. Also because it's a logically hilarious scenario that needs exploration, especially 30 years later. This is without seeing the script. I expect and welcome Leslie's Ghostbuster rejecting being coerced into certain scenarios because black people, as a rule, don't investigate strange noise. Now we can talk about it. Why is this movie is so beloved? Why is this movie so beloved?
Okay, so I got in trouble on Twitter the other day. When this news came out, My initial reaction was it would be hard to find four funnier people to star in this movie. Like, I was not opposed to the Seth Rogen at all dream iteration of this. I think Seth Rogen's really funny. Ugh, but I was like,
thank God.
These are...
I didn't see that. What was the dream iteration?
It was going to be just various Judd Apatow dudes.
Yeah.
And this was 5 years ago.
The people we let make our comedy these
right.
days.
Yeah. And I honestly think most of those dudes are really talented, funny dudes. I have no problem with them being the stars of a Ghostbusters movie. But I have to say, I think this is a better idea, and I think that these four women are, like, four of the funniest people in existence. Like, it would be hard to pick a big, like, a more murderer's row of hilarious people, especially given what exceptionally good performers they all are, in addition to just being funny. But the way I got into trouble on Twitter was that I said that I thought this would be funnier than the original Ghostbusters, especially given that the original Ghostbusters, while an enjoyable film, is barely a comedy.
And I wasn't the only person who revolted.
Now, I have to say, I watched Ghostbusters maybe 3 or 4 years ago for the first time since my childhood, and I was impressed by a couple of things about it. One was... You know, if you watch a blockbuster movie from 1984, 30 years later, you don't expect it to hold up necessarily.
Right, right.
And I thought it did hold up. I really enjoyed watching it through again. I thought it was great. The thing that I didn't remember from my childhood, I guess just because my memory had picked out the funny bits, is that maybe 3/4 of the movie is either Dan Aykroyd saying weird ghost stuff that he actually believes in real life. Or just action and your, you know, pseudo-horror sequences that don't really have very much funny stuff happening in them. And, like, I want to be clear. Like, I don't think this is a problem with the movie necessarily. It's just you realize that because this movie and actually Beverly Hills Cop as well in a different way were at the time inventing the genre of action or horror comedy, you realize that what was happening was there were – some comedy parts, and then there were action parts. And there were funny things that happen in the action parts to some extent. But, like, there's, like, you know, 8 or 10 jokes in Ghostbusters.
It's just if you go back to the beginning of my essay, it reinvented that whole genre. Because after that, movies started having elements. It felt like, okay, we can make a shitload of money if we combine genres, bring two audiences together.
Yep.
I mean, you brought, like, so many different audiences to that movie.
Back in the 80s, when we made a comedy, we blew up some cars.
Yeah.
It also takes a comedy, which comedies can do well domestically,
right,
but they don't necessarily do well internationally. And if you have some exploding cars and stuff, then suddenly the people in the rest of the world are a little more excited about seeing it. It is weird that we don't really have those in the way that we used to. 22 Jump Street, I think, did a really, really charming parody of a chase scene that destroys a bunch of shit and gets as expensive as possible.
Like, awesome.
That was adorable. Do you guys – like, I was so fascinated by every, like, 30-year-old white dude getting pissed off about this movie happening because – like, oh, it's destroying our childhood. We want it with the real cast. And it's like,
I don't want to see 70-year-old Bill Murray chasing after anything.
Bill Murray doesn't want to do it.
He doesn't want to do it. He said no.
Ivan Reitman tried for 10 years to get a hold of him, and he just – you guys know about Bill Murray's weird, like –
you got to fax him and then send it by pigeon and
yes,
then put it on a moat and then...
You, like, call a number and leave a message for Bill Murray.
You got to move in with Bill Murray's lawyer.
Yeah.
And just hang out there until Bill Murray shows
up.
Yeah, and, like,
much.
Ivan Reitman could not get this guy to call him. And he did not want to make that movie. Harold Ramis is gone. Like, time has passed. And it is so interesting that everybody's comfortable with the idea of, like, men handing something off to men, and it would be normal and natural for Seth Rogen to do this.
But I don't even think so. Honestly, this cast is so pitch perfect. How often does that ever happen? I don't want them anywhere near this. I don't want a cameo. You don't even get to go to the premiere, Seth Rogen. I want all of these women to win at this because this is a freaking amazing, perfect group of women.
Well, the other thing I think you'll get is there was that way that Bridesmaids was giving us like an Apatovian movie, but with sort of like the freshness and life of people who were excited to be getting to make this movie. And yes, it had heart to it, but there was also just a relish that you don't get because Seth Rogen and James Franco are going to get to make a new comedy every year or every 2 years.
Right.
And some of them are good and some of them are The Interview. But this is going to have people who are excited to be in the game and are going to show their stuff.
Right.
That's a really good point. I really like that. You know, I mentioned knowing Paul Feig already, but I'm going to say this little thing that happened. So when this news came out, I emailed Paul Feig just to say, like, congratulations. What a great thing. And I don't – like, me and Paul Feig are not, like, best buddies or anything, but because we are both menswear nerds, and he's been on my show a bunch of times and also was on my menswear show, we've known each other for a long time. And he emailed me back, and then he had a little coda in his email. I had not even seen this sort of weird negative reaction because luckily most of the people I follow on Twitter aren't assholes. but he sent me back a little thing about – yeah, it was actually kind of a rough day for him because of all the weird blowback that he got back. And those people get a fucking life. Asshole.
But he got blowback?
But it is of an ilk with Gamergate. It is basically guys saying this is like using nostalgia as an excuse for misogyny. You want to know what? If you grew up in the South in the 50s, you don't get to be nostalgic about some things because some of those things were like apartheid. And I am a man in my 30s and like I'm a gay guy, so I don't want to be nostalgic for dutiness. But we don't get to be nostalgic for all the comfortable dutiness and how 1 in 7 people in media should be a woman.
Well, I think ultimately for straight dudes like me, especially my age, there are a lot of people who are afraid that something is being taken away from them.
There's nothing being taken away from you. Anybody can be a Ghostbuster, okay? Okay? Anybody can be a Ghostbuster.
That's just how Ghostbusting works.
All
you have to do is bust some ghosts.
And you're a Ghostbuster.
And busting makes you feel good.
That's a really good point.
All of us deserve that.
That's a great point, guy.
Okay, but the real question that has been laid down here, and was the universal response of every gay male performer in Los Angeles was, who's going to be Annie Pottsing this bitch? And I've heard strong arguments made for Annie Potts should be Annie Pottsing this bitch.
Yes. Because, you know, the other thing, too, that I found really interesting is that besides trying to figure out who the cursory characters are going to be, I think Jay Baruchel would be a great Lewis. Is the fact that these women, I don't think, are your prototypical beauty queens. They're not skinny. One is a big, giant black woman.
I think they're all very beautiful.
They're beautiful, but that's what I'm saying. Like, they are not what they're – none of – you know, it's not Halle Berry and, like, Jennifer Aniston.
Have we given women an action comedy ever?
The Heat?
The Heat?
Yeah.
Directed by one Paul Feig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a hilarious movie.
Very enjoyable movie. Yeah, I really like that movie.
Speed.
I'm fascinated by the arc of
Sandra Bullock stole speed
of Leslie Jones. You want to know what? Sandra Bullock was really good in action comedies.
Yeah.
God,
Demolition Man.
I miss Sandy Bullock.
She said as though that was a credit, like a positive thing to have been in Demolition Man.
She was in The Net.
I had a Demolition Man mini poster in my room as a kid, and I've never seen Demolition Man.
She was so charming in that movie.
At the Burger King or something.
But like Leslie Jones is, I just love that we had the knife fight about the criticism of SNL for not having a black woman when we had a black first family.
And she gets on the show. She's not even supposed to be a cast member.
I know. And it's such
a Ghostbuster now.
A lovely articulation of this person who seems too old to be added to the cast, who's like, you know, not adorable in the way that a girl is supposed to be adorable, and who got a chance, who got a forum, and was able to, like, hit things out of the park enough that people were like, oh, we know what to do with her now.
Yeah. What I think is really impressive about what she did is that on Saturday Night Live, she imposed her voice on the show. She put herself out there as herself from her own very strong, clear perspective, which is, you know, I think race is part of her perspective. But it's, she just has a strong, distinctive voice that people rarely get to demonstrate on Saturday Night Live, and especially people who aren't white. The expectation on a show like that is that
come up with some characters,
if you are of color, you will find a way to fit in and maybe also play Oprah or whatever famous black person is necessary to be played. But, like, mostly that you're going to have to kind of slide in with the quote-unquote mainstream, the hegemonic voice. You know what I mean? And Leslie Jones came in and she got a break. And she was just like, okay, like, check it out. I'm going to do some real Leslie Jonesy stuff.
They don't hire female stand-ups. They hire female improvisers and they hire male improvisers and stand-ups. And stand-ups are people who know how to do themselves. And, like, Sashir and Leslie are the only female stand-ups they've hired in, like, since Janine Garofalo, I think. And Sashir was definitely came from more of an acting background, both improv and stand-up. Like, Leslie is a person who knows how to deliver a dose of Leslie. And that hasn't always worked in sketches, but goddammit, it works behind the Weekend Update desk. And she was able to, given a forum, say, hey, guys, this is me.
And that definitely works in movies.
Yeah. All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hello, I'm Taku, the Elven Magician.
Merle Highchurch here, the master of clerical magic.
I'm Magnus Burnsides, the fighter.
Did you guys like that? Did you, the listener, like that? You were just swept up in a world of high fantasy and magic where anything can happen and anything is possible.
Hi, I'm Griffin McElroy, Dungeon Master for The Adventure Zone, a new podcast on Maximum Fun,
in which magic and mystery intertwine for a very erotically charged role-playing experience.
You can catch it every other Thursday here on MaximumFun.org or iTunes. It's for Dungeons & Dragons, but with family.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio,
Winter Mitchell.
Jesse Thorne.
Great leader Jesse Thorne is here, you guys, and he's back with his signature segment.
Hashtag that sism.
Do you want to put more S sounds in signature segment that sism?
So, as regular listeners of this program know, I stop in once in a while representing straight white men. I'm the only straight white man involved on microphone in this program. Thankfully, we have Colin behind the boards making sure nothing gets too colorful. But yeah, and when I stop in, I try and focus on my area of expertise, which is, of course, racism. I thought since it was Super Bowl weekend, we could talk about sports racism a little bit. There was one story that actually Oliver shared with me that was absolutely classic, hashtag that sism. This was a high school sports event in Orange County, and this was revealed or reported on by Gustavo Arellano, who's the editor of the OC Weekly and writes a famous nationally syndicated column called Ask a Mexican, and is in general a very funny, charming, interesting anti-racism crusader. But basically, there was a basketball game between two Orange County high schools, Foothill High School and Esperanza High School. And this is, like, unbelievable. But so apparently Foothill has a point guard named Reed Nakakihara, who I'm guessing from his name is probably Japanese-American. And during the game, when he had the ball, the opposing team, their fan section was chanting, among other things, Jackie Chan.
Oh.
And shrimp fried rice. Needless to say that both of those are Chinese things, or in the case of shrimp fried rice, probably Chinese American things, arguably. So hashtag that sism. to the students of Esperanza High School. Rin Nakakihara was classy enough to post on Twitter he's thinking about changing his Twitter name to Jackie Chan. But, like, where is the – where are the people that – the to be fair, post facto, the principal of the school that was perpetrating this horrible nightmare of an act was kind enough to say – that was a conduct unbecoming and we shouldn't – we're very embarrassed of that. But where during the game the coach of this high school team can just say, hold on, go to the – go up to the official and say, can we hold, pause the game for a second and just go over to whoever's in charge of a high school gymnasium. I don't know. I went to arts high school.
That's what I'm saying. You went to an arts high school. That's why I keep thinking to myself, none of this sounds unusual at all.
Okay.
Actually.
So like
– this and, actually sounds typical.
And just be like, hey, guys, the next person who says Jackie Chan or shrimp fried rice – leaves, and the next person after that gets suspended. Like, simple as that, because that is some effed up stuff to say. The end. That's my rant about that. But what I really want to get to is talking about the race issues that surround football and the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. which I think are deeply, deeply fraught. My friend Tom Sharpling on The Best Show, which is a wonderful now podcast, formerly a radio show on WFMU, was talking about the Patriots a few weeks ago. And one of the things that he highlighted that I thought was so apt and so insightful was that when the Patriots cheat, it's called gamesmanship. And it's because they've got a white coach and a white front man, essentially, in Tom Brady. And in fact, they are, you know, they're the great white hope of football, essentially. You know, they play in
I heard they have a white running back.
Yeah, they play in – well, and they've got Rob Gronkowski, the most athletic white person in professional sports. So they
– and my fiancé.
Yeah. Well, God bless him. He's a very handsome man. But like they and they play in a place legendary for its racism, Boston, Massachusetts. But I think it really was called into stark relief when this whole Marshawn Lynch situation went down. Right. And I know this is something that you were following closely, Winter.
Oh, I just think it's funny that he well, here's my whole thing. It's like, OK, I don't follow football at all. So you guys, I'm lost when you talk about it. It just sounds like peanuts, teacher. But I do understand the need to be somebody's hero and the need for somebody like him, he's from the Bay, to not want to be somebody's hero for the sake of whatever. He just wants to get his check and do his job. There's plenty of people out there like that. And I don't think he has to be.
What's the story with Marshawn Lynch? All I know about is gold shoes.
He just doesn't. He doesn't speak to the media, or he has this whole issue with the media. He got fined for not doing an interview, like $25,000. So now he has to be present, or else he's fined for $25,000 every time he doesn't cooperate with a media interview. So he just says stuff like, you know, I'm just here so I won't get fined.
So he literally did. Yeah. He literally did an entire press conference. There are mandatory press availabilities for all players.
Yes.
And his press availability the week before the Super Bowl was to go up. He has to do 5 minutes. It's required or else he gets fined by the league. And he went up and just answered every question with, I'm just here so I won't get fined.
Yeah.
No matter what the question was.
I mean, that's – the NFL is so disturbing just in that – yes, these men are being paid very well, but their lives are controlled and their speech rights are controlled to such an extent. You can't tell somebody you can't say bad things, but also you must say things. No. I mean, he's not a publicist.
But he's not Tom Brady either. Like, Tom Brady can sit up there and yuck and cheese all day long. That's fine. That's great for his brand. That's great for his image. But if Marshawn Lynch doesn't want to effing talk, he doesn't want to effing talk. He doesn't have to talk. He should not have to do that. I actually think it adds to his mystique.
Here's the thing. I think the key issue here is, you know, when this comes up, it's almost invariably an African-American player.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, African-Americans are significantly overrepresented in most of the professional sports leagues outside of hockey. They may be roughly appropriately represented in baseball, but certainly in football and basketball, there are a lot more African Americans in the league than there are in America as a proportion. And I think that ultimately, and I think also it's very clear that white people are proportionately overrepresented in the group of people who are telling their story, who are sharing their narrative. And essentially, if I was an African-American guy, and look, every person in the National Football League is in the National Football League for two reasons. I mean, obviously because they're gifted, but also because they're insanely hardworking and they're emotionally broken.
Right.
This is something I took away from my interview with Terry Crews, who's now a comedy actor and was an NFL player. And it was it is a just brilliant, like a super emotionally sensitive guy. And that's literally what he told me. He said, there isn't a player in the NFL who doesn't have some super deep pain that is pushing them to do this horrible thing. Mm-hmm. Like the idea that people playing in the NFL are doing it and it's like an easy job where they're getting rich. No, these are people destroying their bodies and lives for the hope of an average career that's maybe 2 or 3 years. Like, it is a really tough job. And so if I was in that position and I had to rely on someone who was so completely different from me,
yes, exactly,
as a sports writer is from a 26-year-old black guy that grew up in the hood, had so many horrible traumas to him that his parent became football. And so that's what drives him to make his entire life built around football. Like, I wouldn't want those people to be in charge of telling my story either.
Well, look what happens when they make you into that caricature and you totally fall for it. You become Deion Sanders, period. And, you know, it was funny at the time. It actually was funny at the time. And looking back, I look at, when did this guy have time to practice playing football? He was so busy wearing so many gold chains and wearing, like...
And you hear this word thug, like, okay, as though sunglasses. That's an appropriate thing to say. And I want to be clear here. I'm a 49ers fan, so my natural inclination is to hate anything that anyone on the Seahawks does, because that is their most hated rival and the team that essentially pushed them down out of the playoffs this year. So I have a lot of beef with the Seahawks for no reason at all other than that. But, like, I get it. Like, you know, Richard Sherman is a thug because he tipped a pass and then said he did a great job in the seconds after he did the most important thing in the entire history of his career. Like,
we have cultural narratives. We understand white guy from Polish family from the Midwest. He's just a dude. He likes a good time. And if he throws a punch, he's ha ha ha. But the minute a black guy throws a punch, he is a thug. The minute a black guy, like, brags about himself, he's a thug. And the only narrative we have for black men in sports is obedience.
But the minute Warren Sapp bought 2 prostitutes, he got fired, like, within seconds.
Here's the stories that you get to tell about athletes of different races. A white guy is a smart player, or he's all hustle. He's a real lunch bucket guy.
Yeah.
A black guy is naturally gifted, or he's a thug.
Yeah.
Those are speaking of our hashtag, #ThatSism, by the way, if you notice something racist going down in popular culture, please hashtag it #ThatSism, post it on Twitter or post it to our Facebook page. But a Twitter user named Jefeto Green, or possibly Jefeto Green, I don't know what that name is, highlighted a great little tiny bit that Key and Peele did in their Super Bowl special, where they played like NFL pregame show host type dudes, and they had a white guy come on to talk about how Tom Brady is so hardworking and smart, and how Richard Sherman is a physically gifted creature. and then when Key and Peele brought up that he went to Stanford and so on and so forth, the white guy agreed and said, "Yes, you're right. He is very articulate."
Well, I mean, I remember my dad in, like, the late 80s explaining to me that it was a thing that there were not many black quarterbacks. Is it still a politicized subject?
Absolutely. In fact, when we had on Judge John Hodgman, we did a little sort of sub show about what team you should root for in a sports event if you don't have a team to root for. And Nate DeMayo from the Memory Palace came on the show. He's also a sports journalist. And he had what I thought was the absolute best rule, which was one that his father had taught him in the like late 70s and early 80s, which was, if you don't have a rooting interest, root for the team with the black quarterback because they're not racist. And like that's how – that's almost like if I had to pick a team in the Super Bowl this year, I didn't – I abstained. But had I picked one, I think I would have picked the Seahawks because they have a black quarterback.
Did either
Me
of you
too.
Guys see the bit that Katie Nolan did for Fox Sports 1? It was basically just her saying, hey, we're never going to talk – like we're never going to take the NFL to task on the way players treat women or anything related to women until the people – like the journalists who are covering it include women who are doing something other than checking the web or telling us about the weather. And I feel like we have these – all of the guys who are in their 60s who get to be like official authorities on sports and not a player from 10 years ago are all white guys who are still going to talk about things the way that they learned to talk about them in 1971. And
– but you had Pam Oliver, but you guys snatched her weave literally and figuratively. There were some days I was wondering what was going on up there. But you guys had – you guys had her, and then you took her away, and then you brought Erin Andrews out there, and she's out there, and you know the women. My dad hates it more than anything. My dad is old school, and he's not a prude though, but he just thinks that women who dress like they're going to the club after doing the color reporting, like he feels like, you know, I'll take her just as seriously if she were dressed like a professional.
Because
I'll interject like this.
I'll interject here. Women don't get to do color commentary. They get to be sideline reporters.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what women are allowed to
but
do in professional
because it's
sports.
Tokenism. Because it is, here's a cute girl doing a thing, and we're not that worried if it's done poorly, which implies that a female, like a woman covering football, is just going to be grossly incompetent because she couldn't play it in high school, where some dude who played it back when they still wore leather helmets, like that guy's going to do it better. And
I always think about that scene in Jerry Maguire where they're interviewing when she's interviewing in the locker room and then she drops her mic near the guy's dick and it's just and she's like trying not to look at his dick while she
here's the
it
thing
up.
Here's the
I
thing
always
that,
think about that when in terms of most of these women.
Here's the thing that I think ties these threads together is these sports leagues are cartels. These are monopolies. These are – and in some cases, they are legally protected monopolies. You
yeah.
know, very famously recently, the NFL is a trade association that doesn't have to pay taxes. Major League Baseball has a literal antitrust exemption.
Yes.
And so the question is –
also, it's the – sorry. The Supreme Court decision that gives them a monopoly is – the worst written thing ever. It was Justice Blackmun trying to be a dude, and it fails miserably, and it's hilarious. Sorry.
So, okay. So, guys, Supreme Court nerdery aside, by the way, our guest on the next segment, Nina Totenberg, and the folks from SCOTUS blog. But so there are two side effects of that when it comes to sports journalism. One of them is that you can say, oh, these players have agreed in their contracts to do this. But the reason they've agreed in their contracts to do this is because if you are a professional football player, there is literally nowhere else for you to play.
It's quite literally the only game in town.
Exactly. Like you can say, oh, I'm going to move to Canada or whatever, right? And then for the journalists are completely dependent on the teams and, in fact, often work for the teams. You know, your local broadcasters are employees of the team. And so they cannot do actual journalism. And when they do actual journalism, as was the case with this Frontline that ESPN and Frontline put together that was about the NFL concussion story, if the NFL says, I don't like this, then ESPN says, oh, okay, then we're not journalists. Take
right.
our name off it.
Yeah. Right.
And so if you don't have real journalism, you have this weird kind of professional wrestling storyline writer creation relationship to the league, then why should these guys trust these people to tell their stories?
The notion of being forced to speak is just offensive.
Yeah. It's
gross. You guys are so much smarter than I am in football about football.
All right, you guys. Thank you so much, Jesse, for joining us. We appreciate it a lot.
As a white guy, I have a really high football IQ. I really see the field well.
That's all we have time for this week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with Oliver and Margaret as usual. You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with
Winter Mitchell
and great leader
Jesse Thorne.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Brooklyn SF. Paul Snyder 90, Burden's Burritos, Gene Chaser, Waterfall Nymph, Pete Velcro, and Accidental Charm for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. People who gave us the 1- and 2-star reviews, you know what you can go and do to yourself. If you haven't already, please review us. It'll help get the word out. Get in touch with us on Twitter at PR Pod. Join the Pop Rocket Podcast Facebook group. And next week, we're going to be talking about biopics or biopics. So on the Facebook group, let us know this week whether you think it should be pronounced biopics or biopics. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the very charming Mr. Colin Anderson.
Ayo, can I say one thing? If anybody out there works for Twitter, the person who has at Pop Rocket has never used it, and so we would really like to take it, but it's one of those weird things where you have to know somebody that works at Twitter to ask. It happened for us for Bullseye, but we don't know why or how.
Make magic happen.
Make magic happen.
We love
you. Be nice.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.